may append that, and if I do, it may open my eyes a little bit on it, but really, I can't see much point in it.
You don't see much point in it?
No, it seems to me to be a contradiction in terms in the first place, because history is that which is written, which is recorded. There's no way to close that door, no. You know, it's recorded, it's diaries, correspondence, newspaper articles, state papers, whatever. That's what history is made of. Interviews, of course, but then they are written down and they can be confirmed. But when you go to some individual in some backwoods place and take down his reminiscences, this is what you're doing. You're taking down his reminiscences. Many times they're not, his things he said are not subject to confirmation or any of the tests that normally one carries out, you know, when he's evaluating historical record.
Yes.
So this is one of the reasons that I think that oral history is not history. You know, it's something else. That something else may be very good and useful. People interested in all ethnography, sociology, or anything like that may find some interpretative value from it.
You put that over here to avoid the backlash from the machine.
It's not recording.
I'm just testing it.
Oh. Recent years, and of course, partly I suppose because it is generously funded by the federal government.
I think some of the interviews that I made in connection with the radio show that I did, of course, there it was an audio thing. It was deliberately based on interviews because it was to go over radio, an audio medium. But and I didn't think of it as taking oral histories at the time. But I did learn a great deal about history, the development of Alaska within the living lifespan of the people I talked to. And two things. The content is something you have it verbatim. You can go back, and for research purposes, you can go back and replay your tape and say this man said so-and-so.
Yeah.
And he's an authority in his field. He knows this man mushed dogs to Valdez, for example. And when he describes the way the sled was built or the type of terrain they dealt
sort
with.
Of thing, but that's not history, that's ancillary stuff.
Oh, this is true. These are not events as we define history, but, and secondly, there is the thrill of being able to hear it first person. I really think there is. I talked to one man, he was 96, and he had come over, 98, he'd come over the Chilkoot Trail. And he described in the winter they had had to chip out their foot trail, you know, the handholds in places. And that which is conveyed by the tone of voice, the quality of emotion that comes through, I think it lends a validity.
Well, possibly so, but you know, I had this experience. I had read about William Jennings Bryan and particularly his famous Cross of Gold speech. And then later on, I heard it on a record. It was in a collection. And here was Bryan with the Cross of Gold speech, this golden-tongued orator or silver-tongued orator, whatever he was. And it was flat and uninteresting, and it carried no conviction with it whatsoever, I suppose because of the crude recording in Bryan's days. And then I also heard some of FDR on the same recording. And I can remember his voice and the way he used it and how effective it was. And on this recording again, blah, I was just a tired old man, that was all. So
you lose a lot.
Yeah.
You can lose. You can make or gain, I think, probably. Well, I suppose that's like everything. But I think there are many things that could be done just as well without the tape recording. But as, for example, Mr. Blue, we talked about you were born in Seward and you knew many of the old-timers. And it's maybe in some respects it's easier for me to sit here and talk to you and ask you about your knowledge of those people and let somebody else transcribe it than for us to and put it in the archives for somebody to have it cataloged, because the material is supposed to be cataloged, so that it will be available. And then when somebody comes along and says, I want to do a dissertation on the whatever, some aspect of the settling of Alaska, why they can run through and listen to immortal words.
I'm not sure they're immortal, but they can crack at it if that's what you want to do.
But now you told me that you had hoped to write something of your own.
Well, yes, I am a historian. and I have a couple of projects that I've been working on fitfully and intermittently for a number of years. And then I originally started out as a would-be fictioneer, and I have never gotten that out of my system entirely either. So,
Rick Speech coming up here?
No, nothing at all like Rick Speech. He was, he wrote the adventure type of thing. I used to try to write this when I was a kid, but I have in mind are quite a different type than what Rick Speech wrote. Or Jack London or James Oliver Curwood or any of the writers.
The great dramatic saga sort of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yet, really, there is an honesty, a truth in some of the things that they wrote.
Well, yes, but there was interpretation. Now, you take Jack London's works, like, say, The Call of the Wild, for example. The interpretation that he plays on this is probably something that nobody else in the Northland ever even thought of, all the atavism that he worked into The Call of the Wild, for example. And then, too, to me, it was rather annoying because Buck was an Alaskan dog. He was a dog that had been hijacked from the States someplace.
That is true.
And so that sort of spoiled it for me also, although I used to read Jack London.
Well, that's a very good point. On Alaskan literature, there is a...
In other words, he was like so many people we see in Alaska. He was the outsider coming in. Now, he did, of course, participate in the gold rush. But this has been our whole history. It's been carried out not by Alaskans, or at least much of it has not been carried out by Alaskans, it's been carried out by the outsider. This country is always howled, like Ernest Greening, always crying about colonialism and absentee landlordism and all this sort of thing. Well, I think he overdoes it, but there is certainly a very powerful element of truth in it. The canneries that came up here, they were nearly all of them financed by outside money, for example, Libby and the Alaska Packers and all those. And they resisted any kind of government control or taxation or anything like that. They had it just exactly the way they wanted it. And then as taxation began and the fish went down, well, of course, they ceased being a really important factor in our economy. Now it's oil and things of that sort.
Well, it had to come from somewhere in the beginning. I mean, there was
But
it is unfortunate that it could not have been people coming here, developing here, staying here, which did take place to some extent, but the majority of capital went back outside
again.
That's right.
Well,
I am curious a little bit. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself? Why, how you happened to have been born in Seward?
Well, yeah, my father was a gold rusher. Went to Nome, I think it was in 98 or 99, and worked there. I don't know when he was there once or twice, but in any event, he went to Nome, and I think at the age of 19, and did rather well, and returned to the States, back to the East Coast, to West Virginia, where his father was, and then returned to the West Coast, to Tacoma, and he started a bookstore and took a cousin of his into partnership. And one night the cousin disappeared, and so did the funds, so that was the end of the bookstore. Meantime, he heard about the building of the railroad at Seward, so he went to Seward. Of course, he was being a boomer, so to speak, and so he was one of the very early inhabitants of Seward. I think that he went there in about 1905 or 6.
Is that right?
Something like it was founded in
1903. Well, was the railroad begun that early?
Well, it was Seward was established for the purpose of building the old Alaska Central, the old Alaska Northern Railway.
Well, I didn't know that at all.
That was the purpose for the founding of Seward, in order to get access to the coal lands in the interior.
I see. They were in the just north of Palmer, in that area.
Well,
some of
there were coal mines opened up in various places. Let's see, the Bering field, I think, in the neighborhood of Cordova, and other fields. There's like up at Jonesville.
Yes.
And then, of course, the Ely mine still farther north.
I see.
And many, many others, of course.
Yes. Now, just because of the noise outside, I think I'll see if I can slide a little bit closer here. Because there is a lot of outdoor noise. Seward, Resurrection Bay was explored by the Russians.
Yes.
And did they establish any?
There was a small post or artel there. That of course is very well known here in Alaska. That was the site of the building of the Phoenix by the Russians, a ship that...
Yes, they cast bells even.
Not in Seward, no. In southeastern Alaska, they are supposed to have cast bronze bells, which were taken to California, and some of them are reputed still to be in some of the California missions. I was thinking
they had done something with metal in the Resurrection Bay when they built the Phoenix.
Well, maybe to a very limited degree. Baranov, as you probably have read, attempted to use native iron ore and coal in order to smelt iron, but he was unsuccessful.
I see. But at that point, was what is now Seward, were the landings there, the moorings in that area, related at all to the Russian building?
No, not at that late date. Resurrection Bay, or Voskresenskiy Harbor, as they called it, was utilized for the building of the Phoenix, and it was not used after that. Now the history books are conflicting on this. Many of them say that the Olga and the Dolphin, I think were the names of the vessels, were built there after that, but apparently they were built in Kodiak, Spruce Island, I believe, not at Seward. However, a Russian ship was repaired there many, many years later, one of the Russian Navy vessels. But I don't think there was anything there at the time, maybe just a convenient place to pull the ship up and do whatever they had to do with it. And then, as far as I know, there was no one inhabiting that area until a few people began to homestead. I think the Lowell family is the family that homesteaded there. And they were there when the move to develop the railroad was started.
I see. Well, of course, homesteading isn't normally in what we think of people doing at the turn of the century in Alaska.
I think in Alaska, just as in the West, many times homesteads were developed for the purpose of getting title to the land, not really for agricultural purposes, at least in many cases.
So now, were the Lowells, did they continue to live in Seward?
Well, for some time, this was some offshoot of the famous Lowell family of Massachusetts. Supposed to have been the person who founded this family. He married a native woman, and then they had a number of children. I grew up with some of the grandchildren and knew them well as a youngster. And ultimately, one of the daughters married a Colonel Revell, and they had a family of, I think, three youngsters. And his wife later married Andy Simons, a well-known guide in the country. There's a mountain that's been named for Andy Simons down about roughly 18 miles out of Seward this way.
That I haven't heard that.
Well, that's widely known down around Seward.
Yes. Is there anything written on the history of Seward actually? Has anybody put it?
Yes, from time to time, things have been done about this. I don't think there's been any really extensive attempt to do this that was ever completed. There's a man named Jay Stotter, who was a newspaper man, a radio man, and a writer, and more recently a lecturer over at AMU. And when he was in Seward, he went back through the records of the city council and I suppose other sources, and had a running series of articles called The Story of Seward in the paper then was called the Seward Seaport Record, I believe. So he published, possibly a dozen of these as part of a project which I don't think he ever was able to complete. Presently, he's ill in Glenmore Nursing Home, I understand.
He's in the Glenmore Nursing Home?
Yes.
That would be interesting to see him. He may have...
Yes, I think he'd
have his fingertips on other research. But so much of this stuff gets scattered.
Yeah, well, you see archival materials, as the town records and all that sort of thing, were gathered up and shipped to a record center, I think, in Seattle. Almost been 20 years ago, something like that. And I understand now they're coming back to to Alaska. Apparently, they're going to try to develop a repository here for that stuff, which, of course, is a good thing.
Yes, I hope so. Going back, the Lowells, you said they homesteaded originally, and perhaps to gain title to the land. I wonder, did they have any mining involvement there? Or was there any
not that I know of. I believe at one time they had a little trading post or store which would indicate there must have been other people moving around in the area. I think there may have been other homesteads than the Lowells, however, I really don't know this.
I see. Now, was there a trail, like there was a Valdez Trail, was there a trail into Seward that was a main transportation link to the interior points, interior points?
Not that I know of. There was a trail that ran from Seward up via the Kenai River area and over to the other side of the peninsula, I believe.
I see. To Hope, maybe?
I think Kenai and Milchick, that part of the country.
I see. And of course, there was Indian settlement on the whole Kenai Peninsula.
Yes. See, Hope came later, that is, in the gold rush era, toward the end of the gold rush era. Hope developed as a gold rush town and then died out.
I wonder if there was enough of an Indian settlement in Resurrection Bay for the BIA school system to have been interested or done anything.
To the best of my knowledge, no. There's almost no evidence of any native settlement in that immediate area. I remember when I was a youngster, there were two or three Barabras in the area, but when they were built, or why they were built, or who inhabited them, nobody seems to know, but I don't think there's ever a native settlement there.
Hmm. You know, the glaciers at Valdez, this country has been subject to geological change within the past century,
yes,
I think,
yes.
Much more than people perceive, in so much as, I've seen in the last 30 years the Portage Glacier and the Mendenhall and those glaciers. And as I recall, when the old miners went over the Valdez Trail, the Worthington Glacier, I think they camped on that Worthington Glacier. They had to cross the
Worthington Glacier. That's possible. Of course, it's receded a lot, and as many of the glaciers have. Now, in later years, of course, there were trails. One of them, in conjunction with the building of the railroad, I think, went across Spencer Glacier.
Yes, yes.
In fact, there was
and
one,
that's gone now.
Yeah, well, the glacier's still there, yes, but it has... But this apparently was up over the glacier, or along the glacier, because I remember there's when I was younger, hearing about an incident in which a man was killed on that glacier, whether it was Spencer or who it was, I don't recall, but I remember hearing about it.
But anyway, were there any glaciers that came down into that Seward area?
Not that I know.
As you were a boy, you didn't
No, there were none. There's, of course, a very large ice cap, the Harding Ice Cap, in the vicinity, but it's over on the other side of Bear Mountain.
I see.
And there are no glaciers that, in recent memory, that came down to the level there, no.
I see. That probably was a glacier valley at one time.
Yeah, no doubt.
I was thinking of the Lowells in there, but perhaps it's a... not that recent.
Yeah, well, you see, they must have gone in there sometime around the turn of the century.
Yes.
And because the town was established in 1903 and they had been there prior to that.
I see. So then the town was established for the purpose of building a railroad through
yes.
sort of the coal fields.
Yes, that's the story. And then some people, of course, say that it was built primarily for land development and the selling of land at a high profit rather than... actual serious intent to explore the coal fields. I don't know whether this is so or not. Certainly there was land speculation that took place there. But I always had the feeling the Blaines were intent on opening up the country by means of the railroad. And but before the thing, it went through a couple of reorganizations, you know, and it was Alaska Central, and then it was Alaska Northern Railway. And ultimately, it was bought by the federal government. But by the time the thing was closed down, it had gone out about as far as Spencer Glacier, Moose Pass out in that area, about as far as Spencer Glacier.
Hmm.
Before, about 72, I think it was, before it closed down. And then it just stayed that way for a long time. It was didn't go anywhere, didn't carry any commerce. They did operate a gas car on the thing from time to time. And I know also that some people would hitch their dogs up to a little flat car, you know, a small type that they use in section gangs, and move the car by a dog power. This was, I've seen old photographs of this.
I was trying to think. I think I've seen, you know, that up at Nome they had a railroad, the Nome Express Railroad, and I saw a picture of I think they had horses. It was a photograph that I saw up there pulling a car down there.
What do they call it? The wild goose or something like that?
Yeah, that's right, something like that. Well, there were quite a few railroads that no longer exist.
Yeah, there's one over at Yakutat, for example.
I didn't know that.
Just a little short one. And ultimately, they used it to haul fish with. And I think that later on, after the thing was abandoned, they brought one of the locomotives out of there for an exhibition someplace, possibly even here, I don't know. It was moved out of there anyway.
They have a real nice display of engines up there at Dawson.
Yeah.
I didn't spend any time with it. I was just up there in August, and I took time to take a picture of them, you know, but I didn't spend any time looking over them, but they were all the Dawson. But they have the history of the different locomotives, where they came from.
Oh, there were locomotives? I don't remember seeing
them. Well, little ones. Yes. Yes.
Were they the mine type of locomotive, you know, or what?
The mine type.
There was no railroad up there.
Yes, there was.
Was there?
Yes.
In Dawson?
Yes.
That went from one place to another?
Yes. Went up Klondike Creek. Up Klondike River or to Bonanza Creek.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't a...
it didn't connect to anything else. It was just within the area.
Yeah. It wasn't a commercial type interstate or anything like that, you see.
No.
Or even intercity.
That's right, no. It served the mining field within the area. But that's what I mean. There were these little, 20, 30 mile long or 50 mile long or whatever, out of Fairbanks, the one that went up to Chattanooga.
Yeah, well, I knew about the Chattanooga branch, of course.
Of course, I did connect a couple of towns, but
yes.
The Dawson one apparently just was through the camps, but it hauled the ore, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But, ore, I don't think it was hard rock. It must have been
through all the
concentrates or something like that.
Concentrates, I suppose you would call it.
There may be some hard rock mining up there, but it was, but primarily it was placer.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, there are these little railroads around the country that suddenly appear that you didn't know existed, like the one at Yakutat.
Yeah.
Going back to Seward, and your father, when he got there, what did he do when the bookstore folded up?
I don't know what he did initially. But he and another man started a laundry. I know that he owned a building on the main street there and had all this real old-fashioned laundry equipment. And I think they started this up in anticipation of a big boom, but of course the story of Seward has always been that there was going to be a big boom, you know, next year, but it never really happened. And so ultimately they abandoned this business and went into other things. And I remember that machinery, I used to play in it when I was a kid. It was one of these great big spinners, you know, that the extractors, I guess they call them, that they used to spin the clothes dry in. And it was a great big made out of heavy cast iron. I used to get in that thing and whirl around until we'd become dizzy. And it was indestructible. We couldn't hurt it because it was...
You couldn't hurt it, but could it hurt you?
Well, yeah, you could bang your head on it or pinch your fingers in it or something like that. But there is, a fairly interesting story connected with this. There was a Japanese who came to town sometime when I was youngster, I don't know just when. This would have been probably, 1915, 16, long in there sometime. And he was supposed to have arrived there with little or no money in his pocket. And he started a hand laundry. It was just in an old unpainted building. He had an old-fashioned stove, something like the railroad, you know, the pot-bellied stoves that the irons were put against to heat for the ironing. It was all very crude setup. He hired a few of the local women to come in there and do the ironing, and I don't know how he did the washing, but gradually he began to build up a business and began to prosper a little bit. And so ultimately my father sold this old laundry equipment to him, and that was the beginning of the Seward Steam Laundry, which Harry Kawabe operated there for many years. And when the passenger ships were operating there, well, at least weekly by this time, and so he had the contract to do the ship's laundry, which was very considerable, and he had a good local trade. So gradually he began to acquire some wealth. And by the time of the war, well, I think he was already fairly well off. And one time he started an assay office there, and he had a little importing, export-import store there. And when the war came along, of course, they removed the Japanese from Alaska. This was, what, in December 1942, I believe, was when they...
A year later.
I believe that was the day. You could confirm it by the newspapers. But he and the other, the Japanese whom he had imported to work for him, were all rounded up and sent out to a, we call them relocation camps,
yes,
in the United States, to this relocation center, and remained there throughout the war. And I understand that he was one of the camp leaders, and his business was in the hands of a local lawyer down there. And apparently it continued to prosper. So when Kawabe came, well, Kawabe, was, when he was taken, there were stories about that he was a Japanese spy. A uniform of some sort was found among his effects, and whether it was a club uniform or a military uniform or one he'd had when he was a youngster, or, you know, as a young man, I mean, or what, I don't know. And he was also supposed to have had a powerful radio set, and they didn't specify whether it was a sending set or a receiving set or both, but anyway, he was reputed to have these things. And many people looked upon him as a subversive, a Japanese spy within our ranks. The controversy even made Time magazine in the letters section. I think those who know Kawabe don't believe that he ever was engaged in anything like this, although there was a colonel in the Japanese army of the same name,
you know,
Kawabe, about whom I read in, again, in one of the news magazines. Whether there was any connection or not between the two, of course, I don't know. But anyway, Kawabe became a millionaire. And this little import-export business he had started in Seward apparently became the nucleus. He did start making trips back to Japan, and he started an import-export business in Seattle. Before long, he owned a building down on 2nd Avenue. And then he had a nice shop in the Olympic Hotel, I believe. And he was reputed to be worth some millions. How many, I don't know. But when he died, he left money to build a home for aged Japanese, a sort of home hospital, something of the sort. And that apparently is in Seattle today. Very fine, very beautiful, very elaborate place. So, of course, he had to have money in order to do that.
So that's a wonderful
that's
story.
That's an American success story.
It truly is. Yes, and he got to start with your father's washtub.
Yeah, something like that.
Iron.
Well, he would have made it on his own anyway, because apparently he had the ability to do this thing.
The savvy and the determination and what
it
took. That's great, though, isn't it? That's most interesting.
So, but it's almost ridiculous to think that he was a spy or was sending information back, because there wasn't very much in Seward that they would be interested in. Of course, it was a railroad terminal. And I suppose any enemy would like to knock out a railroad harbor and railroad terminal if they could, but of course nothing.
I think in 1941,
nothing like that happened.
42, and through those warriors, people thought any national of a country with whom we were at odds,
yes,
was likely to be a spy.
And just like when I was at war, anyone with a German name was suspect in the First World War. And when we were kids, we used to set up an effigy of the Kaiser, and then we would vanquish him, you know, with broomsticks or anything, like swords, you know.
Well, I was in school, and used a comic strip expression, Gott in Himmel or something.
Oh, yes, yeah.
One of the school teachers overheard me and called me in, and I was questioned in the principal's office about my...
Served you right, too. Sacrilegious.
Yeah, I didn't know what it meant. But I picked it up in the funny papers or something. But anyhow, that was the nature of suspicion. Well, we still do the same thing, I guess. Human nature is basically continued on. Who were some of the other people at that time who were living in Seward?
You mean when I was a youngster?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see. Were you interested just in business tycoons?
Not in the least. No, I'm just wondering how, about the kind of, what made people go to Seward and before your time when your father was...
When in the early days of Seward, people thought, I believe this very heartily apparently, that Seward was going to be the San Francisco of the North, a great harbor and transportation point.
It looks like it should have been.
Well, yes, the thing that seems to have stopped it is the grade between Seward and Anchorage. See, there's a rather high divide that the railroad had to negotiate.
I see.
And in fact, there are a couple of them. And this was naturally more expensive for and more difficult to for railroad operation. And so Seward always fought any change. For example, when the Colonel Olson proposed to open up Whittier, while Seward was up in arms, this was killing a fine Alaska town of great potential and all this. But Seward was, of course, a very important transportation point up through the war, but it came to an end with the earthquake, which swept away the port facilities there and part of the railroad. And, of course, it never rebuilt to what it had been, because in the meantime, this barge company, I guess it's Sealand, I guess, were able to negotiate Cook Inlet successfully in the wintertime. They would band their vessels, their barges or whatever it was they used, and made their way through the ice. They used an icebreaker part of the time and were able to, just like San Francisco and Los Angeles in a way, they created a harbor where all Seward people said no harbor should ever be and could not be, but...
Here in Cook Inlet.
Yes.
Here in Anchorage, yes.
And now, of course, Anchorage is the, I guess...
Shipping terminus.
Yes, for Alaska.
Yes. Well, by golly, that's right. And that has left Seward out on a limb. And so, what sustains Seward today?
Well, they have some little industry down there. There is a fish packing plant of some kind down there. And there is a minimal amount of longshoring. Longshoring was one of the prime industries down there for many, many years.
The train still does go down there once a week, doesn't
Yeah,
it?
Something like that.
So that there is a little bit of...
It really has become kind of an ancillary port. I think that they get some of the overflow, maybe, that Port of Anchorage can't handle or something of the sort.
And I presume a certain amount of stuff that... Well, I was going to say it would go on to the Kenai Peninsula that doesn't come in here, maybe that interior Kenai Peninsula.
Well, I don't think they use it for general distribution anymore, at least not very much. It used to be that there were little stations along the way, like Moose Pass, for example. Mm-hmm. A certain amount of freight would be discharged at that point. Now, whether that still happens or not, I don't know, but I rather doubt it, because it's all coming the other way now. It either comes directly up over the highway with trucking, or it comes by ship into Anchorage or Whittier, some of it into Seward, of course.
I see.
But Seward is no longer...
There is fishing there, though.
Well,
and tourism? How about tourism?
Well, yeah, there has been tourism over the years there. I don't think it's ever been highly significant, or at least wasn't until comparatively recent times. They started up the Salmon Derby down there some years ago, and I think that that more than anything else stimulated Seward as a recreation spot. And, of course, every year now, many, many people go down there from Anchorage and perhaps a few from other places to all participate in the Salmon Derby and all that. So they have developed a very nice boat harbor and facilities for that kind of operation down there. And this has been going on quite successfully. I don't know how much of an economic stimulus it is to the town. They say that many of the people coming in, particularly the military from up here, take everything with them and have their own... facility, so it doesn't do a great deal for the economy of the town, but it would have to have some effect.
Mm-hmm. Some little bit of input at the time.
Well, everyone probably has to gas up before he comes home, and they probably buy a little bait, you know, and eat a few hamburgers. Things
How
like
about
that.
Commercial fishing?
Well, there's been commercial fishing there from time to time, but never on what you'd call a large scale. There was a, when I was a youngster, there was the San Juan Fishing and Packing Company there, and I think it started up as a salmon cannery, but because I know there were Chinese bunkhouses there. We used to call them chink houses, and because they used imported Chinese labor from the Pacific coast. And then that was converted into halibut shipping, where they would ice the halibut down in big boxes, you know, and ship it out in ice to the market in the States. But it was not a big operation. Then later on there was a small salmon cannery started, but ultimately that company moved over to the Kodiak Island, over to Uganic. And I think the equipment was, the little one-line equipment they had was sold, and again it was operated by some individual for a while, but apparently nothing much came of it. Nels Hagen operated it for a while.
What's his name?
Nels Hagen. Yeah, he's no longer living.
I met him in Kodiak years ago.
Oh, is that so?
Man by that name I met him.
Oh,
anyway.
I don't think it would be this no. Nels Hagen. It could have been, of course, but he was a railroad man and lived in Sword after that. As I say, it's possible he could have gone to Kodiak.
No, it must have been some other.
Well, this man was a large, heavy-set Norwegian. Does that match the description?
That's the description, yes, it does. But anyway, this man was just in Kodiak on a... I met a man by that name, it just flashed in my mind.
Well, that's possible.
In Kodiak, and I don't think that he even lived there, you know.
Well, that's possible. Of course, various people went there from time.
Yeah, yeah, it just rang a bell. But, so anyway, this man, Mr. Hagen, he remained in Surrey.
Yes.
And did he have a family there?
Yes, he had two children, a son who died at an early age, was drowned, and a daughter. His wife survived him. I think that probably she died recently.
You mentioned, when I spoke to you about seeking people from the Seward area, you said, well, of course, there were so-and-so and so-and-so, but they're gone now. Now, could you tell me a little bit about these people that you may have mentioned?
Oh, yes, I can mention, give you a lot of names and tell you just a little bit about each one. There was, one of the big businessmen of the town was a man named Charles Tecklenburg. Spelled the way it sounds. And I don't know just how he made his money, but I think probably he may have been a saloon keeper and this sort of thing. In any event, at a fairly early time, he was pretty well off, and he married a woman reputed to have been a dance hall girl, which is kind of a euphemism for something else. And I remember one incident about this. Tecklenburg was liked and respected by the conventional businessmen of the town, and many of them had dealings with him, and apparently all this was very satisfactory. But when his wife died, he was afraid, because of her past, that nobody would come to the funeral. He was very much concerned about this. But he did have a bang-up funeral, and everybody came, so it was all right.
And he was very happy about that. Isn't that interesting?
Then there's another incident that is often told about him, about old-timers. May was supposed to be a very grasping kind of woman, and on one occasion, so the story goes, and this is, of course, a story, it's not something you can confirm. They made a suicide pact, went down to the dock, and were going to leap off the dock together. But I guess Charlie got up on the bull rail first, and May said, "Oh, Charlie, save the diamond," which he was wearing on his hand. So that was an end to the suicide pact, of course. It was, you know, he jumped first, but leave the diamond.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it's, well, of course, many ludicrous things happened in this, in Seward. I think all of these Alaskan small towns do get these characters, and these very crazy events take place, and of course they're passed on from word to mouth and probably amplified and build up a little bit in the telling.
Yes, what you said, they're not history, but you know they're a part of the history, the color of the flavor of the land. They are not historical.
Well,
events,
yes, they do have. Of course, what is history but people and events and places? You know, if you boil it down to the
the time and the place and just the skeleton of the event, I think you do lose a lot of the reality. And then the historian goes back and he does a fictional biography in which he attempts to recapture. And I suppose that's part of the quality of oral history.
Well, something like that. But you see, the historian. likes to tell himself that he is strictly objective. This goes back to the time of Thucydides, who was the great Greek historian who wrote about the Peloponnesian Wars. And he's referred to as the first scientific historian. I would put scientific in quotation marks. But he determined that he was going to recount the events of the Peloponnesian War with strict objectivity. And pretty soon he found himself in a situation where he wanted to reproduce the speech of one of the characters in the Peloponnesian War, a man named Creon. And of course there were no tape recorders, no shorthand or anything like that in those days. So, and he hadn't been there to hear this speech, so he tried to recreate it the way he thought Creon would deliver it. He probably interviewed a number of people and so forth, but so here in this first scientific history, he found himself having to fictionalize. Now, he did it conscientiously, of course, but it was not history in the strict sense of the word.
Yes, yes.
And I think every historian encounters this, where he has to interpret and perhaps extrapolate a little bit in order to fit a concept that he has developed about this, and so this is what he does. So the very first scientific historian then was guilty, if you want to call it that, of fictionalizing to some extent. Now, he was doing it, as I say, carefully and conscientiously and within the framework of the character of this man as he knew him. So, well and good. We read it in the history books and it sounds pretty good.
And, now, this...
So all historians encounter this thing and they run into censorship where you cannot get at the actual happening. Many people will not make their records available, like the Adams family, until a century later or something like that. So the historian has to work with what he has available to him. And then finally maybe some set of documents is made available to scholars, and then they learn a little bit more. And often they don't find what they're expecting to find either.
Yes, like the lady was saying about the stuff that came up from Russian mission.
Oh, yes, yes.
Speaking of, let's see, Mr. Techtenberg's wife, she was the one that said, save the diamond?
Yes.
Was there much of a line there in Seward?
Oh, yes, that was almost the main artery of business in Seward. This is an exaggeration, of course, but from my earliest memory, we had this alley down in Seward, and many years later it was called Alley B, but we called it what you call it, the line. And it consisted of a string of small houses, most of them cabins, and only one of them really at all pretentious, strung along this little alley down toward the waterfront. It was about the first actual block, the south end of town. And the gals there, I knew every one of them personally and fairly well, because when I would make money, I would do it by selling papers and magazines or delivering packages and this sort of thing. So I would go down to these places and deliver these packages, and they always tipped well. They always treated you very decently. And of course, I suppose in a vague way, I knew what kind of business they were operating, but I wasn't really concerned with it. So I knew many of them. There was one, I remember especially, who lived in Seward for many, many years. Her name was Lida Griffith, and she lived in the big, rather pretentious for Seward, house that was set just a little bit apart. And I think it was probably started to be what in the good old days they called a parlor house. But she lived there, and she lived there alone, and in all the time I knew her, my impression is that she was not practicing, or if she was, she must have retired from her profession when I was quite a youngster. And I can remember going into her house one time. Anytime there was going to be a fireman's ball, we kids would sell tickets. And she would always buy one of these things. She never attended, but she would always buy these public support types of ticket, no questions asked. And so she invited me in, and she was canning fish. She had one of these great big steam canners on her stove, and she was telling me about it, and here she was in a gingham dress and an apron, just like any housewife. Carrying out this domestic chore. And she lived there alone for many years. And many years later, it was learned that She had been married secretly to a man there in town who didn't want it public that he had married a prostitute, and therefore apparently they lived together, but he was never seen with her, never in public or anything like that. I suppose it's part of the old man, the Victorian mentality. And then this was, I think it was after he died that this was revealed. He owned the house instead of Lida and so forth.
Isn't that amazing? There have been so many of these stories. My mother has a beautiful coffee brown diamond ring that was said to have come out of the Klondike. And my grandfather did business with the woman she had married, a doctor. I think after she left here, but I don't know whether it was up here and she came out with him or... Anyway, they had settled in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then the doctor died, and she had a man in her life, and he came to my grandfather one day, and he wanted some money, and to borrow some. So my granddad gave the money to him with the diamond as a stick pin, as a collateral.
Wow.
And then he called this gal, Belle, I think her name was.
Another Belle of the Yukon, huh?
Yeah. And he kiddingly talked her out of it as a ring for my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Had a little story, but she loved she wasn't Diamond Lil, but Diamond Belle or whatever it was. And my grandfather said he'd go over there in the morning on business, and she'd be in an old tattered bathrobe with diamonds in her ears.
Mm-hmm. Well, now these gals down on the line there at Seward, hardly ever would you see one who was in any way attractive. Most of them were pretty well along in years, and there wasn't a beauty among them or anything like that. They were, well, I would say even kind of repulsive women in a way, most of them. Once in a while, some younger ones would come in and practice for a short period of time, but the story was that May Tecklenburg, whom I told you a while ago, owned all of these houses and rented them out. The girls could not own the houses themselves, not counting Lida Griffith, of course. And that she held the price, regulated the rent, and she would, in order to give her former colleagues the right kind of break, why she would set the rent up so high on the more comely newcomers that they wouldn't be able to stay there very long and would have to move on to greener pastures. I think that the business pretty largely was predicated on the fishermen who came into the town and the crews of the ships and so forth. And they probably got a little local trade too, mm-hmm. Some of the
shipping hands.
Well, yes, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if, well, I know that some of the good married gentlemen of the town like to take recreation down there once in a while.
It's usually been the case.
Yeah.
That's what I hear. But up in Fairbanks, of course, there was a very active business.
I remember that old stockade up there by the NC Company.
Yeah.
I don't know what the street was, but.
The short block, I guess, on 4th Avenue, and stockade is the word for it.
Well, these houses, the way it was, let's see, I remember being up there, but it seems to me there was an NC warehouse or something like that, or a power company, and that made part of it, and then there were these, on the other side, there were these little houses, all kind of side by side, and they were just sort of walled in there so that you were directed to this little sort of street that ran through this section, and the ladies would be sitting in there on semi-display, waiting for their
customers.
Clients, yes,
their clients,
to come in and pay them a visit.
Last night, a girlfriend and I were in the Westport Hotel, and a woman came in and she sat down in the lobby in the restroom, in the powder room, and took a single little bottle of, you know, one shot of Seagram 7, and she proceeded to drink it and go on her way, and. She was obviously someone that was out looking. She was shopping for trade. She didn't have her headquarters established quite as conveniently as they used to, you know. My girlfriend and I were talking about the lack of the headquarters. She had to come in the powder room. She couldn't find anybody to buy her a drink. But I went to Kodiak one time, when right after the line had been eliminated there. And the women were complaining because they said it wasn't safe for a lady on the street anymore. That,
well, this old tale has been, this old argument justifying prostitution has been hashed and rehashed over and over and again, but my understanding is that the people who carry out violent sexual acts
Are not the ones that are found on the, you know, seeking women on the line anyway. I know.
Of course, you have to remember that nearly all of the history, there's been a great superabundance of males over females, even counting all the Indians. So I suppose these men, justified or not, felt they had to have some kind of outlet, and this was what provided it.
Yes.
But I don't think that ever prevented any rapes or anything like that.
Well, the women in Kodiak swore that it
had. Well, sure, but this day, just like disease, they used to claim that they used to at least bring forth statistics to claim that the incidence of venereal diseases was much higher among the prostitutes than others. In recent times, this has been kind of refuted in that they have to keep the merchandise ready and available, so
yes,
they're extraordinarily careful, which may or may not be the case, I don't know. But these gals down there in Seward were not attractive. As far as I know, they were required to have a medical examination, I think it was once a week, which is, of course, meaningless.
Is that right?
And they were permitted uptown only at certain hours of the day. They were kept pretty well segregated.
Hmm.
They kept to themselves, and of course, there were always the rumors of protection by the police or by the council. I don't know whether it was so or not, but I think they kept pretty close to the police. That is, in case of any trouble down there, I think they would probably call them.
I see. It was controlled and cooperative within the community, so to speak.
Yes, but always, of course, sort of under the carpet. People didn't like to admit that such a thing existed in our fair city, but it was there, as it was, I guess, in any town of consequence in Alaska at that time. And it probably had some economic impact on the town. I can remember hearing one of the city councilmen discussing the line with my father, and we have to have the line. We can't eliminate the line. It was just a necessary thing. And he's making a strong pitch, retain this. This is absolute necessity to the city, economically and socially.
Who were some of the other business people in Seward?
Two of the very best known ones were Harry Hoban and Al Davis. I believe Harry Hoban was a Canadian, actually, although he participated in politics. Whether or not he became a citizen, I can't say. I don't think so. And his partner, Al Davis, was at one time one of our leading bootleggers.
Oh.
Of course, during Prohibition, there were a good many bootleggers there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You wondered, in fact, I suppose they had to sell to each other in order to keep business going, you know, because the population was pretty small.
They made their own brew.
Made it or imported it. Often they'd make it not in the town, but, you know, on one of the islands or someplace down the bay, and they would bring it in by small boat. And there was one man, I remember there was a man named Matt Schlosser who lived in a little cabin next to the theater, the movie house, and one night when the movie was going on, his house blew up, and here he was right in the shade of the theater, right close to the main street of town, just about half a block away, and his little cabin blew up from whatever he had in there. He had either, whether it was beer or a still, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be a still if it blew up.
Mm-hmm. I talked to a man in Fairbanks who told me of his adventures in making illegal whiskey.
Yeah.
But he said after 2 years, he said the law was closing in and didn't pay to run anything too long.
Yeah.
So he moved on elsewhere. But I guess during Prohibition there was a lot of rum running, and Bootleggers Club right here in Anchorage was named for those operations. They bootlegged. I was told in the 40s. I was told that it was that they ran liquor during Prohibition, but they had also run furs. That the law still watched Bootleggers Cove because illegal furs came in that way.
Well, that's possible. I know there was some of that back when I was a youngster. I knew a man, worked with a man by the name of Nick Bruin, who two or three times was arrested and fined for having a sea otter fur. He would see, in those days it was closed down and you couldn't own sea otter legally, and he had some way of smuggling it to the London market.
I see. But I never understood where it went, and nobody would ever, it was so hush-hush, because I was dating, you know, and these men they were like, not airline pilots, but they were men that they had small bush planes and were connected with local industries of various kinds, and they would never discuss, just they would allude to these, but they didn't talk about it. But that's what it would be, have been the fur?
Yeah, because as far as I know, that was the only illegal fur And of course, fur seals were almost impossible for people to get to. They were restricted to the Pribilofs and handled under government supervision.
And I was too new to Alaska to realize, but they would have gone to the London market, of course.
Yeah.
And they were picked up out here in Cook Inlet, I understood, that they would go down by truck and some boat would come in and pick them up, and so maybe it would take them offshore to a foreign vessel.
Well, that's perfectly possible. I really don't know the details of it.
I'm speculating. I know nothing about it here. Well, anyhow, so, but how about in Seward at that time? Was there any fur trade to speak of?
It wasn't conspicuous. There were a few people who went out and trapped, and I suppose they came in and shipped their furs through the post office. Probably
it wasn't a big industry, though.
No.
On the peninsula.
Seattle Fur Company. No, I know some people knew some people who trapped, but it was very small.
There was no big Seward Fur Company?
No.
What kind of businesses were in Seward at that time?
Well, there was this Alaska Transfer Company that was owned and operated by Hoban and Davis. There was a rather large general store called Brown and Hawkins, owned by a man by the name of Brown and T.W. Hawkins. One time they had a store here in Anchorage.
Yes, I heard that name.
Yeah, and then, but the main, and maybe one elsewhere too, Cordova or somewhere, but they concentrated their activities in Seward. And it was, well, they had a big hardware store, a grocery store, and a clothing store at one time. It was quite an operation, and they did a good bit of business. And then there was at least one other grocery store, sometimes two or even three at times. And there were two or three little hotels and the usual run of restaurants, and there was a drug store. And
it was quite a bit of a
real estate operation, or different ones from time to time.
What did your father do after he was in the laundry business?
Oh, well, ultimately, he became the terminal agent for the Pacific Steamship Company that ran between Seattle and Seward, and he did that for many, many years. He also had other business interests, and he also did the accounting for Hoban and Davis. But that business finally folded. It was a subsidiary of the Dollar Company, I think, and folded during the war, or during the Depression.
Did you have many miners who wound up in the area settling there?
Well,
backwash of the
yes.
miners, like your father came up.
Yeah, there were always people around there who were interested in mining, and there a lot of prospectors came in and out of the town, come in to be outfitted. One of the industries was tie hacking. Men would cut ties on contract for the railroad, and this was one of the local industries. Then there was some fishing in the bay too, carried out by various individuals. The most recent fishing of any consequence that I know of was when the scallop industry was being developed. These eastern scallopers came up and were established in Seward for some time. I don't know whether there are any of them left there or not, but it was going to be quite a big thing at the time. This was just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
I remember reading about that.
And I guess they're probably still bringing some scallops into Seward, but I think that it's shifted elsewhere, the main emphasis at least now.
I'm not going to have a chance to ask you how you became a historian, but quickly.
Oh, well, I've always been interested in the history of Alaska, of course. And it just happened.